all police can, if they want to, steer witnesses. They can get information from experience and training that the person may not want to give up. It comes with experience and training. I, on one hand, say the facts are the facts, and that's what I go by. Some others maybe embellish things a little bit to make it go their way.
You've probably noticed there are a number of witnesses in this case whose stories have changed over time. Witnesses who said one thing to begin with, only to say another thing by the time of Jeff Titus's trial. These changes haven't been random, though. There's a pattern there. Take Rich Adams, for example. He told the original detectives that a man had threatened him in the game area, not far from where the two deer hunters were shot and killed. But after seeing a picture of Jeff Titus, Rich Adams said the man who'd threatened him was not Titus. It had been someone else. But then, 11 years later, the cold case team tracked down Rich Adams and interviewed him again. And by the time the cold case team was done, Rich Adams was saying that the man who threatened him had in fact been Jeff Titus. Or take Jeff Titus's co-worker Michelle. In 1994, she told a VA investigator that Titus had mentioned that someone had been killed behind the farm. But he hadn't said much about it, beyond the fact that he'd been investigated and cleared as a suspect. 6 years later, though, the cold case team tracked down Michelle and interviewed her again. And by the time the cold case team was done, Michelle was saying that Jeff Titus had confessed to finding two bodies in his property and to having taken one of the victim's guns with him. This happens again and again in the case file. A witness has one story, but then they talk to the cold case team, and now they have another story instead. But of all these witnesses with changing stories, the one who mattered the most was Bonnie Huffman.
They had nothing to put him there until they changed the story of Ms. Huffman.
Detective Bruce Racema had interviewed Bonnie Huffman back in 1990, just a little more than a week after the murders had happened.
Initially, she told me that during that time of the evening of November 17th of 1990, that Jeff had come over in his truck alone, that it was in the evening after dark, well after dark, and she thought it was between 8 and 9 p.m.
The story that Bonnie Huffman told Racema had been consistent with Titus' own story about when he'd come by to visit Bonnie and her parents that night. But 12 years later, the cold case team tracked down Bonnie Huffman and interviewed her again.
Subsequent to that, the cold case detectives had re-interviewed her several times, apparently. And her timeline then started changing to earlier in the evening. It was still light.
If you ask cold case detective Mike Workema why he'd been able to solve this case when Detective Bruce Racema had not been able to do so, he'll tell you it's because he's the better detective.
He was pretty close-minded when it comes to Jeff Titus right from the onset.
I don't like being critical, but the way that this case was investigated, the actual time that the people spent on these interviews is amateurish at best.
The cold case team solved this case, Workema says, because the cold case team found evidence that the original investigators missed. But Detective Racema believes the cold case team did not solve this case by finding anything. He believed they used a different method to solve this case.
A witness says one thing that puts him out of culpability, and somebody steers the witness toward their timeline is not something you do. I don't do, I wouldn't do. I take the facts as they come. If they don't lead where I want, then I'm sorry.
Welcome to the Undisclosed Podcast. This is episode 11 of our series in the case of Jeff Titus out of Kalamazoo, Michigan. My name is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2. I'm here this week with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Mm-hmm. At Titus's trial, the bulk of the evidence against him consisted of witnesses who testified to things that he had said or allegedly said in the years and months after the murders. But there was no physical evidence, no forensics to link him to the crime. There were no witnesses who could place him anywhere near the scene. In fact, there were several witnesses who could place him 27 miles away, what Detective Rosima described as a golden alibi. These witnesses said that from 4 to 6 p.m., when the murders happened, Titus had been at the Shepherd Farm, and on his way back, he and his friend Stan had stopped at the Burger King in Battle Creek for dinner, where at 6:44 p.m., Stan had used a calling card to make a call home to his wife. Stan and Jeff had then arrived back at Titus's farm sometime after 7:15 p.m. That was when they'd seen the glow of the lights from behind Titus's field and run to the police when they went back there to check it out.
And then I offered the ambulance and the sheriff's department. They'd come through my property to park right down there. Then the ambulance come later and pulled into my yard, so I sat there and talked to them because I knew them. Spencer's ambulance service. His wife was my daughter's teacher. And so we sat there and chit-chatted. And then I went down to the neighbors and told them what had happened.
The neighbors were Pat and Bob Burnworth, who lived just to the south of Titus's farm. And both Bonnie and her mother, Pat Burnworth, had confirmed to Rosima that Titus's visit had not occurred until very late that evening.
Yes, it was this time. It was dark. My mom was cooking. It was late. We have late dinner, like in Europe. Yes. Boom. It was all laid out there. It's dark. It's between 8 and 9. We know that.
During the cold case team's reinvestigation, they'd interviewed Pat Burnworth twice. She told them once again that she'd seen Jeff Titus at 8 or 9 p.m. that evening. But the cold case team had not spoken to Pat's daughter, Bonnie, at least not before Titus's arrest. It was on April 30th, 2002, just 6 weeks before Titus's trial was scheduled to begin, that cold case team detective Mike Workema spoke to Bonnie Huffman for the first time.
Every homicide I've ever been involved with, after the arrest, there's always new nuggets that come. Always, every case, once the person's arrested, it hits the media, another person will come out and say, that happened in this case too. The media is all over this again, and new facts come out. Jeff Titus gets arrested. Bonnie reads this and says, whoa, wait a minute. It calls us up. We need to talk some more.
What Detective Workema is describing is not actually what happened with Bonnie Huffman, though. Bonnie did not come forward to the police. Detective Workema had found her. He'd been waiting for her at her job one day and had asked to speak to her. She'd agreed, and according to Workema's report of this interview, Bonnie told him a very different version of events from what she'd told Detective Rosima 12 years before.
Here's the Titus house, here's the Hoffman house. She was hunting over here in this field over here. She was walking up to the road to walk home, and moments later, he's in her driveway. And then he proceeds to tell her about the homicide and what's going on. She watched a killer leave the scene.
In her 2002 interview, Bonnie told Detective Workema that Titus had come by her parents' farm between 6:15 and 6:30 p.m. that evening. He'd stayed for about 30 minutes, she said.
The new time, or the adjusted time, places him at the location near the time of the homicides.
Soon after. That would mean if he visited her before nightfall, that he was in the area and could have been responsible for shooting those people near his property.
That's huge.
Very huge. Big. We don't believe that's the case. We know he was at St. Mary's Lake area on White Rabbit Road at the Shepherd and Crandall Farms until dark.
As Detective Rosima acknowledges, Bonnie's statement had been a potentially exciting development for the cold case team. But there was still a problem. Bonnie's news story places Titus and Fulton at a time closer to when the murders happened, but not quite close enough. 6:30 p.m. doesn't work for the prosecutor's story, because not only do Stan and the Shepherds both say they saw Titus at their farm just after dark, but Stan Driscoll also has a phone record that places him and Jeff at the Burger King in Battle Creek at 6:44 p.m.
14 minutes, right? 6:30 to 6:44.
Yeah, it's 14 minutes.
That's 14 minutes.
Yeah, it would not be possible. It would not be possible for him to get up there, pick up Stan on White Lake, on White Rabbit Road, and get to the Burger King on North Street. No way.
Maybe if it was 6:15, because then that would be...
Still wouldn't.
Still not.
Still wouldn't.
By the time of Jeff Titus's trial, Bonnie Huffman's story has changed again. And in this third story, the time of Jeff Titus's arrival at her parents' house has moved earlier once again, by nearly an hour.
And then it's almost like someone pointed out, well, it couldn't have been 6:15 and 6:30 because he was back at the Shepherd's at 6. So then at trial, it changes to 5:30, 5:45.
So... it almost seems like somebody was steered in a direction, led a witness, maybe led to believe certain things, which some people do.
Right.
And I'm not saying they did, but it's been known to happen.
Back in 1990, when the Fulton Gainberry murders occurred, Mike Workema had been a detective with Kalamazoo City. He was in a different jurisdiction from the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office, and so was not involved in the Deer Hunters case. But in the early 1990s, he pulled a couple of cold cases down from the shelf and managed to solve them, and that inspired him to go to the prosecutor's office and persuade them to begin a cold case task force. Several jurisdictions in the area, including Kalamazoo County, Kalamazoo City, and Portage City, had all contributed funds that they'd received from federal grants to create a new interagency cold case team. Though, as cold case detective Rich Madison explained, this funding was only good for one-year blocks.
And then the opportunity came along where the cold case homicide team was started in 1998. And it was a... apparently all jurisdictions get federal money that they can do what they want with it. And the whole county, all the departments agreed to put that money together to start the cold case homicide team.
For this funding, and therefore the cold case team, to continue on, the county and city governments involved would have to renew the program annually.
Well, you know, we were always kind of year to year.
The cold case team's funding issues weren't a secret. In Titus's case, the cold case detectives had been quite open with them about the funding concerns they'd had.
But that's when he told us that... once that they solved this case, that they would have 100% success rate, and that they could go on, and there would be a whole department developed around to do cold cases. But if they didn't solve 100%, that they wouldn't be able to. That it was going to be shut down.
They told you that.
Mm-hmm. Detective Brown did that in the Kalamazoo Police Station.
So he was telling you this is a high-stakes thing for us. We should see we're 100% perfect and we get a division for this.
Yeah, he said that they already had all but one case solved. They had, this was the last case that hinged on whether or not that they got a cold case team for Kalamazoo.
These funding issues were further complicated by the fact that the Kalamazoo Cold Case Task Force was an interagency unit, with funding and detectives contributed by several law enforcement agencies. And each of the agencies involved had wanted to get something out of it for itself. After all, why keep paying for a cold case team if they're only going to solve cold cases for other agencies? That's why, in 1999, it had been decided that the cold case team needed to find a Kalamazoo County case to solve.
And I think we had done a city case between the Deer Hunter. So we had done a Portage case, a city case, and, you know, our command was kind of looking at us, knowing we got some open cases too, and kind of saying, well, we ain't going to work on this. And we wanted to anyway. But it was kind of time for a county case to be resolved. And so we picked this one up. And I personally feel that Mike Workema and Mike Brown wanted to do this so bad, they had blinders on.
Some members of the cold case team claimed their unit had 100% success rate. Going into the Deer Hunter case, Workema says they were batting 1,000. Every case they had opened, they were able to bring successful convictions and closure. They were getting a lot of momentum and a lot of attention from the media. And everyone likes hearing good news, Workema says, especially from police agencies. And now, the cold case team was bringing good news. Workman says he liked working cold cases. He'd learned over time that when you're working a cold case, you can hear new things from witnesses that the original investigators had never been able to hear. His strategy, he said, is to reach back out to the same people who were talked to back then and to use different angles than were used before, and to use respect, passion, and compassion. He would show them pictures from the case, or pieces of the victim's jewelry, whatever it was that helped him to play on the witness's emotions. The thing he always used, he said, was to draw on people's desire to bring closure for the victim's family. Workham says that his interview style involves going out and talking to a witness, hearing what they have to say, then going to another witness and learning something else from them. He'd then go back to the first witness with this new information and would use that to help the first witness remember something more than they had before. And then you repeat the process again and again until you find out what you need to know. Detective Workham calls this process waking a memory.
What I learned with time, attitudes and allegiances change. When people say, no, I don't remember, and I would convince them, yeah, I do remember, I'm just not too sure I want to talk. And then it's a process. I would meet people three, four, maybe six times.
But there's a downside to this process too, as Workham himself acknowledges. You do that five or six times, he says, and you write five or six reports on that, and then the defense attorney looks at that and says, look, every time you talk to the witness, she told you something different. Workham's response to this is, well, yeah, the witness is telling him something different each time, he explains, because every time he talked to the witness, he brought them another tidbit of information that he'd learned, and with that new information, the witness remembered things a different way.
I've spoken to several witnesses who recalled having multiple interviews with Detective Mike Workham, and yet, in the case file, there's only a single report of one interview for them. I can't help but wonder if at times Workham was consolidating these five or six multiple interviews into a single final report. Because if you do it that way, the defense attorney can't see just how often the witness's statements have changed. But the bigger problem here is that Workham's self-described technique for doing interviews is not an interview technique. It's not a process for obtaining accurate information from witnesses. What Workham is describing here is a textbook process for how to induce false memories. You take someone's actual memories, and then you combine those real memories with information that you tell them has been corroborated by others. This leads eventually to source confusion, where the witness can no longer recall whether this new information is something they remember themselves, or it's something they've been told. And when you repeat this process over and over again, a significant proportion of your witnesses will develop false memories. That outcome has been replicated in numerous scientific studies that have used a process very similar to Workham's interview technique to reliably induce false memories in test subjects. Detective Workham denies that he's ever done anything to improperly influence a witness's testimony. And when Jacinta told Workham about how Detective Worsema had said that it was possible for a detective to steer witnesses in this manner, Workham had objected.
Integrity is everything. And I mean, that is the cornerstone of police work. You can't jeopardize your integrity. But the notion that someone would think I would lie, I took offense to that.
The thing is, Workham didn't have to be lying about anything here. To induce someone to have a false memory, it's irrelevant whether the person who's doing the inducing has any idea that that memory is false. Detective Workham could have genuinely believed that he was waking a memory, without ever realizing that what he was really doing was creating one instead. This technique of waking memories wasn't Workman's only tactic for solving cold cases, though. He had a few other tricks up his sleeve as well. When Jacinta first began working on this case and first began talking to Jeff Titus, he told her about one possible suspect that he was really hoping her team would be able to investigate.
So I wanted to ask you, I know you, last week I had asked you about how you heard the name Benny Klomp.
Yep, Bernie Klomp, and that was through Rick Vanderbilt.
Yeah, can you just tell me that story again, like where that name, how that name first came on your radar?
Because he's an inmate here. He used to be from Kalamazoo, and I don't know the whole story on him, but he come to me and told me. He said, Jeff, you should look into Bernie Klomp. And
this guy always seemed to know everything that was going on with the case and everything. And he would turn around, and I even had one of the CEOs turn around and tell me, said, this guy knows everything about your case.
This inmate that started talking to Jeff in prison was Richard Roy Vindeville. And eventually, Vindeville told Jeff that he knew who had committed the murders that Jeff was in prison for. It was a guy named Benny Klomp, Vindeville said.
He said there was a contract for $15,000 on Estes. And he's a drug dealer, and Estes had stole a bunch of drugs from him. So he put a contract on him. And then Klomp knew about this.
Now, was this something your lawyer ever looked into?
Like I say, they didn't put a lot of stock in this guy. But this guy sure knew an awful lot.
They didn't put a lot of stock into the inmate.
Yeah.
Now, here's this guy from Kalamazoo, who just happens to have an encyclopedia-like knowledge of Jeff's case, and who, for unexplained reasons, seeks Jeff out in prison to tell him who he thinks really committed the murders. And Jeff takes all of this at face value. It doesn't really seem to occur to him that maybe he should question what's going on here. When I first heard this story, it set off alarm bells for me. There was something not quite right about how detailed his knowledge of Jeff's case had been. For instance, one of the things that Vindeville told Jeff was about how, on the day of the murders at the Fulton Game area, this guy Benny Klomp had actually been there.
He was telling me that he was out there that day, and it was in one of the reports that he was out there.
And
it was in one of the later cold case files.
Later, after he'd had this conversation with Vindeville, Jeff had been looking through his case file one day when a line that was buried deep in one of the cold case team's reports had jumped out at him.
I actually found it. It took a long time, but I found the report.
You did find
it? Yeah, and I'm trying to pull it up right now so I can read it to you. So this is a further interview with Bobby Brown by one of the detectives. He advises that he also noticed an individual by the name of Benny Klomp.
Rich Vindeville is not the first guy to ever come forward with claims about firsthand knowledge of someone placing a hit in Doug Estes. There have been others who made this claim as well, though in each instance, the claim has come from a witness whose credibility I would rank on a 1 to 10 scale as -3 or lower. And Doug Estes' stepson, Bobby Brown, has always dismissed the idea that these allegations of a hit could have any relevance to the case. Because when Bobby, Doug, and Doug's friend Mark had gone hunting that day, they'd only decided to try out Fulton after the three of them had loaded up into Mark's truck and headed out. So it wouldn't have mattered if there had been a hit on Doug Estes, because no one could have known he'd be at the Fulton game area that day. No one, that is, except for the people who saw him when he arrived.
So you're coming down X Avenue, you think?
Yeah.
Did you pass by any of their parking lot areas? Or?
Yeah, where they keep their camper, the McNeese.
The McNeese? So you drive past it and you see them and anyone else, or?
I thought Benny was there. I'm sure he was there.
So the McNeese, Junior, Howard?
Yeah, one of them. They look about the same.
I think they do.
Yeah, they do.
Not on Facebook.
They both had great big long beards. But, yeah, there was four or five people there, I think.
Yeah, so you've seen them, you're like, oh, it's crowded here, let's keep going.
Yeah, I knew that there was another spot just up past that creek where you could pull in. And yeah, that's where we went.
Bobby is certain that it was the McNeese he'd seen in the parking area that day. He'd known the McNeese family well. They lived just across the street from where Bobby had grown up. Bobby knew Benny Klomp, too, and he says he is certain it was Klomp he saw there with the McNeese. Klomp, he says, has some very distinctive facial features.
Because Benny Klomp was missing the end of his nose.
Imagine.
He was fighting with his wife, and a window cut his nose off. He looked like a Gordon's fisherman.
Bobby's right that the McNeese family had been in the parking area on X Avenue where Bobby remembers seeing them. A week after the murders, a reporter from the Detroit Free Press had driven down to the game area to interview hunters in that area. He hadn't found many. After the murders, most hunters had decided to stay clear of the game area for a while, but he did find one group that remained. He took a photo of them with their camper in that parking area off of X Avenue. According to the article,
the McNeese men have been setting up deer camp on a swampy patch of public land south of Battle Creek every November for the past 28 years.
Every year, Earl Sr., 62, and his sons Howard, 41, and Earl Jr., 35, stayed until each got his buck. But the grisly discovery of two hunters shot to death near their camp November 17th may change all that. With the murders fresh in their minds, there's talk among the McNeeses, who had just one buck among them by Sunday afternoon, of cutting their stay short this year. Maybe, they said, they won't return next year. You used to be out here, if you walked upon another guy, you stood for a while and talked about how many deer you jumped, said Earl Jr., arms crossed while tugging at a full, shaggy beard. I don't let anyone walk up behind me anymore, Earl Sr. said.
This is actually not the first time you've heard about the McNeese hunting party on this podcast. We've mentioned before how on opening day of 1990, a group of hunters had shot a buck on property that belonged to Jeff's neighbor, Alan Stanton. The hunters had lied to Stanton about having permission to hunt there, and when Stanton found out, he'd been angry. That group of hunters had been with the McNeese hunting party. And Benny Klom's presence at the McNeese campsite in the day that Doug was killed is something that Doug's stepson Bobby Brown has wondered about over the years.
Were there ever any other leads or things that you thought about that you thought maybe...
Benny Klom.
It's a Benny Klom.
Because I thought if there's anybody crazy enough to do some shit like that...
It's Benny Klom.
Goodbye, Benny.
He's on cocaine all the time, just fucking high strung.
But was there
attitude? Had his no. It's just always bragging up his boys because they knew karate and shit. He's a weird dude.
But obviously, he told me a story once about like Ben coming over to the house and
yeah,
going down the blinds.
She was high on cocaine.
Given how close the McNeese campsite had been to the murder site, and given that, at least according to what the McNeese told the Detroit Free Press, the McNeese had remained hunting in the game area even after the murders happened, you'd think they'd been quickly interviewed by investigators. They weren't, though. For unclear reasons, it wasn't until 1992 that Wersima was able to interview them. His report reads,
both Earl Sr. and Howard McNeese advised that they didn't know either Estes or Bennett. They had gotten there on 11-13-90 and left on about 12-1-90. They normally hunt west of the creek, into the swamp area wearing waders, and have been calling there since 8 or 9 years ago. Howard advised that he had been there and had left on that particular Saturday. He came back to town and had gone back Sunday morning when he heard about it. These individuals report no suspicious activities or any problems while they're camping, and were very surprised to hear what had occurred. Subjects were surprised that the police had not contacted them at the campsite during the time in question, but had no real information to pass on anyway.
When Wersima interviewed the McNeese, they'd suggested that they hadn't been at the game area when the murders happened. But they'd still been there at least until 2 or 3 p.m. that afternoon, when Bobby had seen them as they'd driven into the game area. But there's another witness Wersima interviewed shortly after the murders, who had told him something curious. This witness had been hunting across the road and down a little ways from the McNeese campsite. And he told Wersima about something he'd seen that day.
About 5 p.m., just after the witness heard two shots, he observed a hard-sized, small trailer leaving the area on X Avenue. As he was leaving the area, he heard some people yelling, but could not hear what was being said.
This witness had heard two shots, then seen a trailer drive away, and then he'd heard the screaming begin. And the only known trailer that had been in the X Avenue area on the afternoon of the murders had been the one that belonged to the McNeese. In that cold case report of Bobby's interview, the one where he told the cold case detectives about seeing Benny Klomp and the McNeese at the game area, the detectives had followed up by asking Bobby if Norberto Agonesis, who was a friend of Bobby's and Doug's, had also known the McNeese and Benny Klomp. Which made us wonder, did the cold case team have some reason to believe that Norberto did know Klomp and the McNeese? And when Jacinda and Susan spoke to Norberto, it was one of the things they'd wanted to follow up on.
What about Howard McNeese, or Junior McNeese?
I know McNeese.
Do you know them having a problem with Doug?
I mean, you have to understand, Doug didn't take a lip from nobody. It didn't matter who it was. If he thought he was in the right, he was in the right, and somebody was going to get knocked out.
Did he ever knock any of the McNeese out, though?
He got a really bad scuffle over at the tap room with him. This was about... probably a year or so before that.
Was it Junior or Howard?
It was the old man.
The old man, okay.
Yeah. So I think that probably the young guys were really upset because Doug had never gotten into it.
So he was not a young man.
And yeah.
Seems kind of like an unfair fight for Doug to have fought him.
Doug didn't give two shits. If he was in the right, he was in the right.
So the McNees did have a problem with Doug.
Yeah, because they couldn't do anything other than shoot him to get rid of him. Because he was bigger than them, tougher than them, and badder than them.
So there,
even two of them at a time.
There was a problem there?
Yeah, there was a problem there.
If Norberto was right, then, theoretically, the McNees might have had a problem with Doug if they'd seen him drive into the game area that day.
So, I don't know. I mean, I don't believe it, but I'm now curious if that's to be true. Did they, like, see y'all driving in that day, and they're like, oh, that's that bastard who beat up our dad.
He was sitting on that side of the truck.
Doug had been sitting on the side of the truck that was closest to the parking area, so Bobby thinks it's possible that Benny Klomp and the McNees could have seen Doug through the truck window. But Bobby says even if they had seen him, he just doesn't think they'd have had any reason to care.
You didn't know of any beef between Benny Klomp and your dad or your stepdad?
No.
What about the McNees?
I didn't think they knew each other.
So, Norberto, being Norberto, told us a story. I don't know.
He's a storyteller.
He is, but his story was that he fought the McNees' dad, who was like 50 or 60 at the time, and the McNees' boys were angry about it. But that's from Norberto, so...
Why is he trying to throw a wrench in the gearbox all over the place? That dumb little weirdo.
I don't trust Norberto's stories. On that 1 to 10 scale of witness credibility, Norberto's hovering somewhere around negative 10. But there were enough coincidences in this whole Benny Klomp thing that I was at least curious about what could be going on here. The obvious person to ask about all of this would be Benny Klomp himself. Unfortunately, Jeff Titus had told Jacinda that he didn't think it'd be possible for us to go talk to him.
No, I heard Bernie Klomp turn around and shot himself after he killed his wife.
So you're saying he killed his wife and then he shot himself?
He killed his wife and shot himself after that. But Rick Vanderville was the one that told me this. And he says, I still say it was Klomp that was the one that was down there.
It turned out that Vanderville had been right. Once I figured out how to spell Benny Klomp's name... And let me tell you, that took longer than you'd think. I've been able to confirm that he had died, and in exactly the same way as Vanderville had described. And I'd been able to see then why the cold case team had also never had a chance to speak to Benny Klomp. Because the first time they'd heard about him was April 27th, 2000, when they'd interviewed Bobby Brown for the first time, and Bobby had told them about seeing Benny Klomp at the game area that day. The cold case team's notes from this interview had been prepared and typed up 4 days later, on May 1st, 2000. And that evening, Benny Klomp had killed his wife and then himself. As far as I know, Benny Klomp was never contacted by the cold case team and never knew what Bobby Brown had said about him. I've gone through the case file for his murder-suicide, and there's nothing in there that would connect it to the Fulton Game Area investigation. Shortly before the murder-suicide occurred, Klomp had confided in a friend that he thought his wife was having an affair, and that was assumed to be the motive for the crime. Klomp had told his friend the name of the man that he thought his wife was seeing, and the address where this man supposedly lived, though it's curious that when the police tried to investigate it, they couldn't find any evidence that such a man had ever existed. Still, from what I've been able to dig up so far, I haven't seen anything further to suggest that Benny Klomp was involved in the Fulton Game Area case. Nor have I found anything to explain why Rich Vanderville was so eager to convince Jeff Titus that Klomp was the one who'd done it. While looking into this whole Klomp thing, I decided to try and learn more about the source of this rumor. I asked a number of current and former law enforcement officers in the Kalamazoo area if they'd ever heard anything about this Richard Roy Vanderville. And from a number of them, I'd gotten the same curious response. That's the guy that killed the Poldermans, isn't it? They'd said. Marinus and Sari Polderman had lived in the township that's just to the north of Fulton. They were a couple in their 90s, and their 62-year-old daughter often stopped by to check on them. In August of 2000, all three were found bludgeoned and stabbed to death in the Poldermans' home. The case went cold for a while, but eventually five people were convicted.
including Rich Vindeville's 19-year-old girlfriend and his 17-year-old niece. But Vindeville, who was 39 at the time, had never been charged himself. Though, for some reason, an awful lot of police officers in Kalamazoo seemed to think he should have been.
In 2002, Vindeville was convicted of a different crime. He was found guilty of stealing a purse that had been left in a car overnight and received a sentence of 20 to 40 years. At a sentencing hearing in this case, Vindeville had given a statement on his own behalf. He'd asked the judge to take into consideration all he'd done to help the community, and to give him a lighter sentence because of it. Vindeville told the court,
"I am the reason for area crimes being solved, and without my knowledge and help, these crimes would not have been solved. I can prove that the clues and information that I have given to these Kalamazoo area cold case homicides were the reason they were solved, and was my sole responsibility."
Vindeville named two cold cases that had been solved with his assistance. Assistance, he said, he'd been able to provide thanks to the assistance the cold case team had provided him, by giving him information about these cases that only the police or the killers could have known. As Vindeville explained at his sentencing hearing,
"The Kalamazoo Prosecutor's Office allowed their detectives to destroy clues and information in these homicides. The detectives contaminated the case by having Mike Workema take me to various murder scenes and give me information that I had already told him these people were admitting to doing these murders. This information was not available to the public. It was used in hopes against the suspects to further solve the crimes of cold case murders. Workema gave me information so that I could release clues and information against Kalamazoo area suspects. I was also placed in the same cell with a certain suspect for the cold case team, which was Jeff Titus."
Years later, Vindeville had written a number of letters to Jeff Titus's attorneys. In those letters, Vindeville explained in greater detail how while he was in jail in Kalamazoo County, he'd been alerted by a deputy that Workem was bringing in someone who'd been charged with a homicide, and that Vindeville should gather whatever information from the suspect he could. That suspect turned out to be Jeff Titus. After Jeff had been booked in and placed in his cell on A North Block, Workema had arranged to have Vindeville pulled from the cell and brought in to meet with him in private at the jail. During this meeting, Workema had told Vindeville all about the Fulton Game Area murders, as well as Titus's work history at the VA hospital. Vindeville's mission, Workema said, was to get whatever information from Titus to help make a case against him. But, according to Vindeville, he told Workema he thought Workema had the wrong guy, that he didn't think Jeff Titus had done it. The murder of Bennett and Estes had been drug-related, he says he told him. Vindeville says that Workema had come back to the jail again later to meet with him again, and Workema had told him Titus was a dirtbag who was hiding some things that Vindeville should try to find out. But Vindeville says he told Workema the same thing he told him before. Estes and Bennett had been killed because of drugs, not deer.
In this case, there are an awful lot of witnesses that I do not trust. But out of all of them, I trust Richard Roy Vindeville the least. To put it in the mildest of terms, he's an unreliable narrator. In his communications with Titus and Titus's attorneys, Vindeville has his own agendas he's trying to work, and nothing he says can be taken at face value. Still, some of Vindeville's claims, if true, ought to be trivial to verify. For instance, Vindeville says that he was placed in a jail cell with Jeff Titus and instructed to report back on confessions or other information that Titus gave him. But if Vindeville really had been placed in a jail cell with Titus, like he says, then the jail would have a record of it.
And Jeff Titus's attorneys checked into just that. They filed a FOIA request for records of what cells Jeff Titus and Rich Vindeville had been held in during Titus's stay at the jail following his arrest on December 12, 2001. For Jeff Titus, the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office had no problem providing the requested records. Jeff Titus had indeed been in a cell on A North, just like Vindeville had said. But as for where Vindeville had been held, the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office could say only this.
"We can confirm Richard Vindeville was booked in the Kalamazoo County Jail November 5th, 2001 to January 9th, 2002. However, we do not have record of cell locations for Richard Vindeville. We have determined that the requested records do not exist within our agency."
Vindeville was at the jail when Titus was booked in. That much can be confirmed. But whether Vindeville really had been placed in a cell with Titus, like Vindeville claims, There's no way to know for sure. The records that would confirm it are missing. One thing that we can verify, though, is that Vendeville does indeed know a lot about the Fulton Game Area murders and how the cold case team conducted its investigation in that case. Vendeville knows things that were never publicly reported and were never part of any court proceedings. He has to be telling the truth that there was someone who was sharing that information with him. The only question is who the someone was.
In his letters and in a statement at a sentencing hearing, Vendeville did give one clue as to someone who might have more information about all this. He mentioned his sister a number of times and said that she'd been a longtime associate of Detective Mike Werkema's. His sister had met Werkema, Vendeville said, when Werkema was still working as a street-level cop. So Robbie and I had gone to speak to Vendeville's sister, and we learned some things. Though afterwards, we'd both been a little lost for words.
Oh my God almighty.
Oh boy.
Oh my God.
What did we just walk into?
Holy shit.
Let's get out of here.
Well, first of all, he sounds...
When we'd told Rich Vendeville's sister that we were there in Kalamazoo to investigate a cold case that Mike Werkema had been involved in, and that we wanted to talk to her about her brother, her response had been, Mike must have said something to you about Rich, huh? We told her no, it was the other way around, but we were curious about whether Vendeville had really worked for Werkema, like he'd said. She said yes, Vendeville had given information to Werkema, but wasn't really working for him. Vendeville was, quote, just cutting deals to get his ass out of bullshit. Though Vendeville's sister did confirm that he'd been responsible for solving at least one of the cold cases that Vendeville had named at a sentencing hearing as one of the ways that he'd helped the community. Vendeville's sister also confirmed that she and Detective Werkema had known one another for years, just like Vendeville had said. Werkema was like a brother to her, she told us. He'd been her guardian. But most of what Vendeville's sister had been able to tell us about had nothing to do with the Fulton Game Area case. She had known more about other cold cases in the area. The Deer Hunter murders was one she had no direct knowledge of. Her brother had told her a few things about it, though. She remembered Vendeville saying that the Deer Hunters had been killed over a dope deal, and that he'd known who'd actually been the one to kill them. Once, she said, when they were driving together on 35th Street out near Comstock, Vendeville had pointed at a house and told her that the person who'd been behind the murder of the Deer Hunters had lived there. Vendeville's sister said that she'd thought that he'd given her names, but this many years on, she could no longer recall who it was he'd said.
A number of the claims that have been made by Vendeville have to do with Kalamazoo's Silent Observer program. Silent Observer is the tip line where people can call in information about criminal cases, and if that information leads to an arrest, they'll receive a monetary award. When Jacinda and Susan spoke to cold case detective Rich Madison, he told them what he remembered about how the Silent Observer program worked in Kalamazoo.
Silent Observer thing where they could remain anonymous, or but they typically didn't give that information out.
Who ran Silent Observer?
One lady that has since passed, and it was a committee of people. Howers was a girl by the name of Janine, and she's the sheriff's assistant, basically.
Much like Baltimore's Crime Stoppers program, Kalamazoo's Silent Observer program is ostensibly an independent, nonprofit organization. But in both Kalamazoo and Baltimore, there's not much daylight between these tip line programs and the law enforcement agencies that utilize the tips to get called in.
No, we just make contact directly with Janine.
And how would the money get paid out if it was paid?
They would issue a check.
And just like with Crime Stoppers, Silent Observer has been used by detectives in Kalamazoo to secretly pay witnesses for the help provided in solving cold cases. In one of Vendeville's letters to Titus's attorneys, Vendeville had included a newspaper clipping about another cold case that Werkema had been involved in. In 1988, the elderly owner of a bike shop had been bludgeoned to death, a robbery that had been the killer's apparent motive. The case went unsolved for over a decade, but then the cold case team got involved. Detective Mike Werkema re-interviewed a number of witnesses, and some of those witnesses changed their stories, leading to the arrest of Scott Allen Baldwin, who had worked at the bike shop about 3 years before the murder happened. Baldwin was convicted in 2001, and the prosecution's star witness in the case had been Baldwin's ex-girlfriend. But after Baldwin's conviction, his attorneys had learned the cold case team had some unusual interactions with their star witness. Prior to her testifying at trial, Workman had given Baldwin's ex-girlfriend copies of her prior statements to help her remember while on the stand everything she'd told the cold case team before. And after the trial, the star witness had received something else from Workman too. As described in the Kalamazoo Gazette article, in a section Vendeville had marked with yellow highlighter,
"As for the reward money that Baldwin's ex-girlfriend received, Workman said police submitted her name for reward money from Silent Observer and that she received the funds after the case against Baldwin had been adjudicated. Workman said that the woman was completely unaware of the reward until she received it."
Like in the Baldwin case, a Silent Observer award had also been offered in Jeff Titus's case. In fact, the cold case team had widely advertised this reward at Titus's former workplaces, in order to encourage his former co-workers to come forward with information about Titus. They had also advertised it around Fulton. But in Titus's case, we don't know who the reward money ultimately went to. That still remains a mystery today.
I haven't been able to speak to Detective Mike Workman myself, but Cold Case Detective Mike Brown has always been willing to share his thoughts on the investigation. So I'd asked him about Bonnie's story and what he thought of it.
And I do have a lot of questions about Bonnie Huffman.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think happened there?
Well, I never talked to her, to be honest with you. I didn't talk to her, so who was it to talk to her?
Workman.
Yeah, there you go. I didn't talk.
Even Detective Mike Brown, who has always been the most enthusiastic advocate for Jeff Titus' guilt, does not place any significance on the changing stories of Bonnie Huffman. He didn't talk to her, he told me, and he had no part in it. And since he knows nothing about it, he's not going to make any effort to defend what was done to obtain her testimony in the first place.
I'll put it this way. It doesn't sound like you put much... You're that concerned with Bonnie Huffman, are you?
No.
It wasn't her that you think puts him at the crime scene.
I'm not concerned with Bonnie. I'm not concerned with a guy in a ditch. I'm not concerned with any of that. None of that.
But even if Mike Brown isn't concerned about Bonnie Huffman, the jury at Jeff Titus's trial had been. She's the only evidence that connects Jeff Titus to the crime scene, and all the other eyewitnesses say that he wasn't there. My best chance of figuring out why Bonnie Huffman's story had changed was to talk to her. So late last year, I spoke to her on two different occasions. The first time, Jacinda and I had gone together, but that interview was not recorded. Then, about a month later, I decided I needed to try again. It was too important not to. I went back to talk to Bonnie, and she'd agreed to a recorded interview. Unfortunately, Bonnie's dogs had been super excited about being on a podcast. They barked. A lot. I've never tried harder in my life to make friends with a dog, but it didn't work. While attempting to interview her, though, I asked Bonnie the most important question I had for her. When Jeff Titus had come by that night to tell them about the murders in the Fulton game area, what time had it been?
Did he come by? When did he come by?
That night, he did that. I'm going to say it was around 8 o'clock.
After you weren't living there, but you got home that day.
Right. I wasn't. This guy, Pop. Enough's enough.
8 p.m., Bonnie told me. That's the same thing that she'd told Detective Orsima 30 years ago, in 1990, when he'd first asked her the same question. It was also the same answer that Bonnie had given Jacinda and I before when we talked to her the first time, a few weeks earlier.
Okay, but she was very clear that it was at night.
She did say it was dark.
Like, she said it several times.
Yeah.
If you ask Bonnie Huffman today what time it was when Jeff came by, she will tell you that she is sure it was very late in the evening, well after dark. And that brought me to the second most important question I had for her. Why, then, had Bonnie given a different answer when she was testifying at Jeff Titus' trial? Bonnie said she didn't remember much about the trial at all. In fact, she told me, she only had one clear memory of what had happened in the courtroom that day.
Do you remember at trial when you testified?
Oh, I remember his blue shirt and blue tie.
Oh, his nice tie.
Nice tie.
What did he say about that? Did he,
Oh, I told him he had a beautiful tie.
So he just said, thanks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bonnie remembers telling Jeff when she saw him in the courtroom that day that he'd had a beautiful tie on, although she'd known it probably wasn't proper for her to be speaking to the defendant directly.
I know. I've never forgot that. It was such a nice tie.
Even after talking to Bonnie, I still don't know why her story changed. Was the story she gave at trial just a false memory that, in the 20 years since, she's now forgotten that she ever remembered in the first place? It's possible, I think. Or is there something more going on here to explain it all? In trying to answer this question, there was something else Jacinda and I had wanted to ask Bonnie about. Had you ever heard anything about a reward being offered in this case, we asked her. Nope, she said, immediately. Very immediately.
All right, did you believe her about the reward?
It was the quickest answer of all the answers.
It was the very quickest answer she gave the whole time.
Yeah.
It was a very confident answer.
It was a very, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just being paranoid, but I'm glad that you thought the same. Because I was
thought of everything we asked her that she remembered.
And in any event, the existence of the reward money is not necessary to explain what happened here. As Detective Orsima noted, there are much more straightforward explanations for why and how a witness's testimony can change.
Why does it change in this kind of a case? Somebody is more than likely led you to doubt yourself and is steering you to make it more beneficial to the case at hand.
Although Bonnie Huffman's story about when Jeff Titus came by that night has been notably inconsistent, the same is not true for her mother. Across three police interviews and in her trial testimony, Pat Burnworth's answer to this question was always the same. Titus came by at 8 to 9 p.m., she said. And because Pat Burnworth has been so consistent about when Titus came over that night, her testimony has gotten less scrutiny in this case over the years. But even though Pat Burnworth's story about when Titus came by that night has remained consistent over the years, the rest of her story has not. Take, for instance, her strange claim to the cold case team that Titus liked to walk into her house and search through her cupboards looking for food. And her equally strange, although much more incriminating claim, that Titus was somehow confused about his property lines and didn't know where his property ended and began. And then there was the claim she made to the cold case team, and also repeated at trial, that on the night Jeff Titus came by her house, he'd told her that he'd just found two dead bodies in the woods, and he'd not yet told the police about it. So no, Pat Burnworth's story about what time Titus came over didn't change. But every other part of her story has gone through some dramatic changes. And when talking to others about this case, Pat Burnworth has made a number of inconsistent claims. Helen Noss was the neighbor who, along with her son, had gone down to speak to the man who'd run off the road and gotten stuck in a ditch at about 5 p.m. on the day of the murders. In both 1990 and 2001, Helen Noss told investigators that they should speak to Pat Burnworth because Pat Burnworth had told her that she'd seen the car speeding away after the murders before it crashed into the ditch. And when I spoke to Kelly Warren, the daughter of Jeff's friend Big Jack Warren, she told me about how, the week after the murders, she'd gone over to Jeff's property to hunt. While there, she'd had a conversation with an older woman who lived in the farm across the street from Titus. A woman who, based on Kelly's description, could only have been Pat Burnworth.
I'm hearing it down there when we were hunting. But that goes back to that car that was speeding away with the two people running out of down from along beside Jeff's barn at the same time, and that old farmer across the street, and some lady seeing them running out of the woods, but they didn't have nothing, like no guns or nothing. And they weren't dressed appropriately to be hunted.
And then there was a call that was made to Silent Observer back in 1990 from someone who had heard a similar and yet very different claim from Pat Burnworth. The tip read,
Pat Burnworth, who lives near the scene, reportedly has told people in the Fulton area that a few minutes before the screams, one of the neighbors helped three drunks out of the ditch. Also, that everyone thinks that Titus is the killer, as he's told many people that he's a state trooper, and while being armed, kicked people off his and state property.
Not only are all these reported statements from Pat Burnworth contradictory to one another, there are also things that Pat Burnworth and her daughter Bonnie never repeated to the police in their interviews. Neither Pat nor Bonnie ever told the original detectives about hearing screams, or seeing three drunks, or a speeding car, or men running out of the woods, or even that they harbored suspicions about Titus being the killer. So, where then were these stories coming from?
While Jacinda and I were down in Fulton, we'd wanted to speak to one of Titus's neighbors, a guy named Jerry, because he'd lived near the ditch where the ditchman had run off the road, and we were hoping he might have seen something. It turned out, though, that he'd only moved in after the murders had happened. He had heard a lot about the Titus case, he told us, but everything he knew was just secondhand.
So, how did you find out? Do you remember?
My neighbor, actually.
Which one? The
Burnsworth.
They told you about it, yeah.
Well, Pat was alive then, and Pat knew a lot about it.
What'd she know? What'd she tell you about?
It's conversations between him and things that he's done in the neighborhood that weren't so great.
I've heard from several people in Fulton that back in the day, if you'd really wanted the inside scoop about what was going on around town, Pat Burnworth was who you should be talking to. Jerry would agree with that.
Pat kept on up on shit. She was a bit of a busybody. She's very outspoken, and she was a good person. I really liked Pat. Spent a lot of time with her.
Just social, like?
Oh, I used to have an Amish buggy with a horse. I'd take Pat, pick her up, take her for rides all the time.
Oh, that's cool.
We'd ride around the neighborhood. Nice. And sometimes I'd ride up the bar and get drunk. Come home.
It's not always possible to track down where a rumor comes from. But when it comes to rumors about Jeff Titus in the Fulton area, well, in the cases where I was able to trace the rumor back to its origins, 9 times out of 10, these stories were coming from the same place.
He apparently grew marijuana somewhere up around here.
Well, I've heard that he did, too.
Who?
Titus.
Oh, no. He's kind of straight-laced.
Well, some people were saying that, you know, for the money he had invested in that place, that he was living so much, somewhat financially out of his means. Oh. But I do remember that conversation coming up.
Oh, is that with Pat? Or?
Yeah, I think through Pat, but...
I had not meant to laugh in this interview, but the idea of Titus secretly growing marijuana just caught me so off guard. No, Titus did not grow marijuana in his cornfields. His wife Julie's parents had helped them buy the old Stryker farm, and Titus and his father-in-law had done a ton of carpentry work on the old building. They turned it into a picturesque farmhouse, but it hadn't started out like that. And I am certain that absolutely no drug money had been involved in repairing it.
I didn't know that much. I heard that rumor about him.
But it was
but
a
I heard
common rumor.
Also, he's very territorial.
Jeff Titus?
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear that from Pat?
Mm-hmm.
This claim that Jeff Titus was territorial is one of the more persistent rumors in this case, but it's also one that's puzzled me ever since I started digging the case file. Because everyone up there is territorial. You're weird if you're not territorial. Jerry himself, for instance, has strong feelings about his property and makes no apologies about it.
And it seems like no one here likes hunters on their land.
No.
So that doesn't seem weird to me.
It's a respectful thing, you know?
You don't want people you don't know with guns running around.
It's not so much that. It's our fucking property. You want to get on my property, ask me. Or if I say no, keep your ass off here. Whether I got five, my parents got 600-700 acres. Wow. And we run into shit constantly. It gets old. You know, this is our property. We pay the fucking taxes. Keep your ass off it. It's that simple. I don't walk into your house, wander around your house, yard. Then you should show me the same respect.
Is it a regular problem up there on their property?
Everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah. I was back on my parents' farm that we've owned for generations, walk into my deer stand, and some guy says, "What the fuck are you doing here?" And you're saying that to me, and I've got a loaded gun on me. I just quit hunting because I got tired of this shit. Because I'd shoot somebody, you know, you get sick of this shit.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Especially during hunting season here near the game.
Just in general, you know, it's a matter of respect.
To give some perspective on the kinds of baseless rumors that Pat Burnworth was spreading around about Jeff Titus, just consider this. Pat managed to convince this guy that Jeff Titus was unusually territorial. And these sorts of rumors were spreading beyond the Fulton area, too. Take Marion Gibbs, for example. She gave the extremely damaging testimony at Jeff Titus's trial about a conversation that, supposedly, she'd had with him at the sawmill that her husband ran. Marion had also heard lots of rumors about Jeff Titus, rumors that heavily influenced her views of him.
You know, and there were rumors going around about how he had bullets lined up on something, maybe the mantle of his fireplace or something, mm-hmm. You know, that supposedly were four specific people.
What'd you hear about that? Like, did you ever hear any names, or?
One of the ladies that testified, she was a neighbor of his.
No. Patricia Burnsworth?
Pat Burnsworth.
Got it.
Yeah, Pat.
Marianne was not the first person, though, that I'd heard this particular story from. Because Bonnie Huffman had told me the same thing.
So, tell me about what you were saying earlier about the bullet.
Our name was on them.
Bonnie Huffman said that Titus had written her name and her mom's name on bullets that he kept in his house. And Bonnie was certain this was true because she'd heard it from an extremely credible source.
I don't know where they would be now, but I do know. But they were above the door.
So the detective told you about this?
Yes.
This is where I need to stress that there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Titus ever had a bullet with Bonnie's name on it. That part of Bonnie's story is not true. It didn't happen. But I do wonder if the other part of Bonnie's story could be true. The cold case detective who interviewed her had been Mike Workema. Could he have really told Bonnie that Titus literally had a bullet with her name on it?
Did the police tell you this to warn you? Or just...
They warned us.
Okay.
What Bonnie Huffman is describing would be gross misconduct by Workema. She's making serious allegations against him, whether she realizes it or not. But I'm not so sure it really was Workema who told Bonnie this, even though that's how Bonnie recalls it today. I think it's possible that this could be another false memory, another conflation of sources. Because I haven't seen evidence of Workema telling any other witnesses that Titus had bullets with their names on it. But we do know someone else who told people that. Bonnie's mother, Pat. She'd told the exact same story to Marion Gibbs, after all. So it's at least possible, anyway, that Bonnie was really told this story by her mother. And now, years later, she's misremembering it as something Detective Workema told her. False memories can be tricky like that. Whoever it was that told Bonnie the story, Bonnie truly seems to believe that Titus had bullets with her name and her mother's name inscribed on them. And we know from Marion Gibbs that this is a story Pat Burnsworth really had been telling others even before Titus's trial. Though it's far from the only story that Pat Burnsworth was telling others about Jeff Titus. There were other stories, too.
You know, Pat had said that Jeff had come over to her house and basically said he had basically what Pat said, that he confessed. I thought that was interesting, and Pat had talked with me about that, and it was probably not something that she was supposed to do, but she had a conversation with me before we went to trial and told me these things. And it was like, oh, I certainly wouldn't want to have been living that close to him.
After speaking with Marion, Jacinda and I had started to realize just how damaging all these unfounded rumors had been to Titus's case. No, the rumors themselves weren't repeated in court, but they didn't have to be in order to influence witness testimony.
Two things that stood out to me that I hadn't thought about before is that it was in Bonnie Huffman or Pat Burnsworth's and in these people's and everyone around Fulton's best interest that Jeff was convicted. Because if he wasn't, the picture that they painted of him was so scary that you would
do anything to make sure he didn't come back.
You would do anything to make sure the conviction.
That's all for episode 11 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks on February 15th with episode 12. But don't forget to send us your questions for this week's addendum on Thursday.
Amit Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. Music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logos, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is @undisclosedpod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.